President Obama's administration and Congress are rewriting the rules of the U.S. financial system. The plan tries to grapple with big questions like what to do about institutions, say AIG and others, so big or so complex that if they fail, it could derail the entire economy. Alex Blumberg is on NPR's Planet Money team, and he's taken a look at how the Obama plan approaches this problem.
To answer this question, I consulted two experts. Simon Johnson, a former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund and currently at MIT's Sloan School of Management, and Charles Calamiris, an expert on banking and financial history from the Columbia University Business School. They come from different ends of the political spectrum. Johnson supported Obama, Calamiris worked for McCain, but they agree on a lot. Here's Charles Calamiris, followed by Simon Johnson.
The thing that probably is bothering Simon as much as it's bothering me the most is the idea that big firms that failed didn't have adverse consequences. Capitalism has to have consequences for losers.
The last banker who we know who was executed for bank failure is Henry Fauntleroy in the 1820s. I'm not proposing to bring back capital punishment, but I think Charles had it right. The losers must lose.
Okay, so here is what's strange. Charles Calamiris, the Republican former McCain advisor, he likes the Obama plan, says it addresses this problem. He gives it a B. Simon Johnson, the Democrat and Obama supporter, gives it an F. So why the discrepancy? Well, they disagree on one essential question about the plan. A question Simon Johnson phrases like this.
Is it Jamie Dimon proof?
Jamie Dimon is the chairman and CEO of JP Morgan Chase, one of the largest financial firms in the world. And I should be clear here. Simon Johnson is using Jamie Dimon here as a symbol of all the heads of all the largest banks and financial institutions in the world. Citigroup, Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, AIG, all these huge global interconnected firms that, when they get into trouble, their CEOs can go to the government saying, if you don't bail us out, the economy will collapse.
It's a bizarre kind of blackmail, right? It's a very sophisticated sort of oligarchy that we've created where the power comes from not saying we'll have you all assassinated, but saying, well, guys, if you want the Second Great Depression, go ahead. Make us all fail. That's fine, but it's your call.
One more thing to point out. Simon Johnson isn't saying this threat is not real. It's pretty clear that Fed Chair Ben Bernanke, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, and President Bush all truly believed that the world economy would collapse if they didn't step in to prop up large institutions like Citigroup and AIG. But to Johnson and Calamiris, the fact that it's true makes this threat even more important to deal with. And Charles Calamiris believes that the Obama plan is starting to deal with it, because, he says, the plan sets up something called a resolution authority, a kind of bankruptcy for really big companies. Some branch of government can step in when there's trouble, reorganize the failing firm quickly, and get it up and running again. Unlike what we face with AIG or Lehman, there's a process in place. An added benefit, under the Obama plan, the management gets fired, and the people who own the firm, the shareholders, lose money. The losers lose. Simon Johnson says the Jamie Dimon problem is way bigger than simple rules. To prove his case, he sets up a little in-studio drama right there using me and Charles Calamiris as props. He imagines a scenario sometime in the future. Calamiris' plan, which is similar to the Obama plan, has been put in place, and there's a new financial crisis at hand. Simon Johnson is playing the Jamie Dimon role. His bank is in trouble. It's about to fail and fall under the resolution authority we put in place back in 2010, long ago. And then he comes to see me, the president.
I say, all of these systems that were built in a bygone era. The realities of today's financial system, it's global, it's interconnected. 2.5 billion people will be plunged immediately into poverty when these accounts are shut down. There is no way that that was envisaged by the Calamiris legislation.
At this point in our fictitious future scenario, Charles Calamiris, who, remember, is playing himself, can no longer contain himself and writes himself into the drama.
And then, of course, you call me. So I can give you some good advice, because you need it desperately, which is, let's look at this factual counterfactual and see whether there's any possibility that he's right. Well, let's see. Hold on. The bank continues to operate with a different manager. The stockholders in this bank lose some money. Since those are the only differences, exactly why is that going to cause a systemic crisis?
You know, and then I paid you. and I say, you know, Charles may be right, but, you know, me and everybody else on Wall Street says that this is going to melt down.
Now, if you're wondering how the actual Jamie Dimon would solve the Jamie Dimon problem, we did reach his spokesperson for a comment. He comes down on the Obama-Calamiris side of this debate, supports the Obama plan, in fact. He says that big firms like his are fine as long as the government is there to ensure that if they need to, they can fail in an orderly way. This week, the Associated Press reported something that Simon Johnson says supports his argument. They reviewed Secretary of Treasury Tim Geithner's phone and appointment calendar over a period of 7 months after the crisis last fall. And three people showed up a lot, more even than key leaders in Congress. Who was the secretary talking to? Lloyd Blankfein, CEO of Goldman Sachs, Vikram Pandit, CEO of Citigroup, and, you guessed it, Jamie Dimon. And to Johnson, this is the point. Bigness leads to power. Power leads to access. And when there's a crisis, the people with access have influence. So what you have to do is get rid of that power. Make sure that no individual institution is allowed to get big enough to take down the whole system. That way, this future scenario we just rehearsed would have a much different outcome.
It'd be much better when we're having this conversation, this structure, if Charles could turn around and say, what are you talking about? Jamie Dimon used to be 10% of U.S. bank assets. Remember, we downsized them. He's only 1% now. He's tiny.
We understand Simon Johnson's views on this. And I guess the response is the following.
Diana Farrell is President Obama's deputy assistant for economic policy. She says that within the administration, as they were developing their plan for the financial system, they had many arguments, like the one between Simon Johnson and Charles Calamaris. The problem with Johnson's approach, they decided, is that bigness also has its benefits. Sure, the economy used to be simpler and financial institutions weren't so big and dangerous, but GDP was smaller then, too, and people were poorer. We can discuss a time before we created huge, complicated institutions like Citigroup and AIG all we want, says Farrell. But
we have created them, and we're sort of past that point. And I think that in some sense, the genie's out of the bottle, and what we need to do is to manage them and to oversee them, as opposed to hark back to a time that we're unlikely ever to come back to or want to come back to.
In the end, what we should do about that genie comes down to how you think about it. Farrell's view, and the view of economists like Calamaris from Columbia, is that the genie does lots of good things for us, and that we can learn to restrain it. For Johnson, the good things that the genie does are outweighed by the bad things, and we should be thinking hard about how to get it back in that bottle before it wreaks havoc once again. For NPR News and Planet Money, I'm Alex Blumberg.
Let's turn now to a broader discussion of how China's growing economic power and its other interests may have, in the view of some China watchers, trumped human rights. Here's NPR's Frank Langfitt.
China's influence with the United States has been increasing throughout this decade, but this year it gained a lot of ground. The United States sparked a global recession, and China, thanks in part to huge government stimulus spending, is helping to lead the way out. Nick Lardy is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, a Washington think tank. Lardy says the U.S. is reluctant to irritate China these days.
I think in the midst of an economic crisis, the administration's kind of bending over backwards.
Bending over backwards, Lardy says, to ensure cooperation on big issues, including boosting the world economy, addressing climate change, and dealing with North Korea.
I think postponing the direct visit between the president and the Dalai Lama is, if this helps a little bit in that regard, I guess that's the calculation in the White House.
Human rights has always been downplayed for these larger interests.
That's James Mann. He works at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and he wrote About Face, a history of China-U.S. relations. When President Nixon went to China in 1972, Mann says it had nothing to do with economics. It was about countering the Soviet Union. Human rights became an issue in the summer of 1989. When the Communist Party unleashed tanks on student demonstrators.
There were a couple of years after the Tiananmen crackdown, when human rights were a more significant element of American policy, but they didn't last long.
A key reason, in 1992, Chinese leaders began to fully embrace capitalist-style reforms. Foreign money and American business started to pour in.
Picking up in the late 90s and in this decade, the amount of foreign investment in China and the amount of trade between the United States and China has just skyrocketed.
China used the money it gained from a giant trade surplus to buy U.S. debt and, in recent years, became America's banker. Again, James Mann.
The result of that has been enormous economic leverage in dealing with the United States.
We still have a larger economy than China, so I don't think we should be in the position of quaking at the prospect of raising difficult issues with them.
Mary Beth Markey works for the International Campaign for Tibet, which focuses on human rights there. She says as China joined the world economy, pressing the campaign's agenda became harder. Before 2001, Congress had to vote on trade relations with China each year. Markey and others used the vote to highlight China's human rights record and force Congress, in essence, to vote on it. But when China joined the World Trade Organization, that forum disappeared.
When that annual vote went away, then Congress need not pay as much attention.
That means Markey and other human rights advocates have less leverage.
You can work as hard as you want, and you can bring an army, and you can bring the media, and you can bring, you know, the Speaker of the House to the table. But in the end, the decisions are made by a very small group in the White House, I think.
As economic ties between China and the U.S. continue to deepen, making the case for human rights won't get any easier. Frank Langfitt, NPR News, Washington.
I'm Ethan Lindsay in Bend, Oregon. I'm standing in one of the city's newest neighborhoods, but it's actually just a bunch of empty home sites right now. There is one house being built a couple of blocks away, but it looks pretty lonely. Anyone in town will tell you this was one of the fastest growing cities in the entire country just a few years ago. But when the state and regional economy collapsed, it took the local building and construction trade along with it and the city's growth.
Well, the funny thing is to see all these homes that are half built.
Michael Woolley is an out-of-work carpenter.
You see the raw plywood up and there's no siding or nothing. I mean, as soon as that crash hit, everything stopped.
Woolley and his wife moved to Oregon in 2004. When everything stopped, home building companies laid off thousands of roofers, framers, and general contractors, including Woolley.
Oh, gosh. The facts of life really start to hit you in the face, and you're like, wow, you know, I got to feed my family, you know, put a roof over their head. For a while, I had to wash dishes.
Oregon's 12.2% unemployment rate is the fourth highest in the country. Big local names have slashed their payrolls. Brightwood Lumber has gone through multiple layoffs in Central Oregon over the past 2 years. So far, it's cut more than 20% of its 1,000-person workforce. The largest private company in the state is Jeld-Wen. It makes doors and windows, and over the past 2 years has cut hundreds of jobs across the state, including in Bend. In March, the company even laid off 50 people from its administrative staff. At the state unemployment office in Bend, out-of-work job seekers take computer classes and apply for jobs. This downturn may have started with home building, but now it seems to affect everyone. Carolyn Egan is a regional economist with the employment department.
Of course, we have the people who are swinging hammers and laying concrete. Also, we need the engineers and the architects who've designed the lot and the house, not to mention the people at Home Depot.
All the different job losses pushed Bend's August unemployment rate up to 15.8%. That's almost three times what it was in 2006. But it hasn't been a nonstop descent into job despair. In fact, over the summer, economists thought they saw a turnaround. Some landscaping and engineering firms rehired workers. But those green shoots withered quickly. It looks as though it was a seasonal uptick. Egan says she knows firsthand the impacts of the housing slowdown.
I was working for an engineering company here in town doing the traffic study. So for every commercial or residential development, there has to be a traffic study submitted. And so I lost my job last August and was unemployed for 6 months before I got my job here with the employment department.
There aren't enough state jobs to go around, Egan knows. And she worries that if the recession lasts much longer, people may start to move out of town. Woolley, the out-of-work carpenter, says he'll likely move to Salem if something doesn't turn up here soon. For NPR News, I'm Ethan Lindsay in Bend, Oregon.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. President Obama says there is an urgent need for jobs creation. And while the Fed chairman, Ben Bernanke, has called the recession probably over, he adds that the pain will persist for the unemployed. And so far, he's right. The national unemployment rate is pushing up against 10%. It's expected to surpass that point before all the trouble is over.
For some states, that's old news. Their unemployment rates have already jumped past 10%. We're going to start this hour with stories from Ohio, Oregon, and California, stories behind the numbers. First to Ohio, where the unemployment rate is nearly 11%. Here's Dan Bobkoff of member station WCPN in Cleveland.
The story of Inkstop is a worker's nightmare. For months now, the company kept assuring its staff, selling printer ink and office supplies, that everything was fine. They were expanding. They were hiring. There were just some speed bumps along the way because of the recession. Then, last week, and without warning, the company abruptly shut down.
You know, I knew things were tough for the company. I didn't think they were that tough.
Greg Rothaker was an Inkstop store manager for nearly 2 years. He got a call late last Thursday that he wouldn't be going to work the next day, and he wouldn't be getting the more than $2,000 in back pay he earned the past few weeks. Now he and fellow manager Brian Wolf stand outside Rothaker's former store in Strongsville.
Yeah, you were only here a little bit longer than me.
There's no note to customers on the door telling them of the closure. Only a few stickers from UPS drivers who were, understandably, unable to deliver shipments. For Rothaker, it's kind of gallows humor.
As you can see over on the door, our Inkstop brand ink is 75% off. Don't know how you're going to take advantage of that deal, but good luck to you if you can.
Rothaker says the first warning sign that things weren't totally rosy at Inkstop was a dwindling supply of ink. There hadn't been a shipment since June.
Or as Brian put it, ink stopped.
Still, he believed the company's assurances that everything was okay. Now, locked out and laid off, Rothaker and Wolf spend their days applying for jobs online. Rothaker was about to become a homeowner.
The doors closed at Inkstop on Friday. Saturday, we got a call from the realtor saying that the bank finally approved our offer, and it was just such a heartbreaker for my wife and I.
He has 5 days to find a job, or the deal is off. That's why these two Ohioans don't want to hear that the recession is finished.
They say that the recession's ending, the recession's over, you know, we're out of the woods, we're out of the dark, you know, you can hear the munchkins singing now, and the answer is wrong, you know. I mean, if you look around, you know, you see a lot more of this happening.
For NPR News, I'm Dan Bobkoff in Cleveland.